Accession number 21613, Rule 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Peter David Cockburn Salmon in his home in Perth, Western Australia, for the Imperial War Museum, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Peter, I'd be interested in you telling us, describing to us, Tobruk, the place.
Mm.
You mentioned some of the details. Could you describe the actual place to us?
Well, it's a very flat place. It's desert. It's not a sandy desert like the Sahara. Well, the Sahara, it's a scrubby sort of desert with small scrub, very flat. You've got no landmarks to go by at all, and we were living in these cement dugouts with slit trenches which dug, where the ground was very, very hard, and you couldn't to get down to dig slit trenches. And we were doing night patrols. Now, when you went on night patrols, what we had was we used to have a field telephone run way out, and when you went out, you'd pick up the line from the field telephone in your hand and let it run through your fingers. And the only way you knew where you were going is you let this run through until you got to the end of the telephone. Because the only navigation you had in the whole desert was the North Star. And if anything happened to disrupt us and we got into a skirmish or something like that, the only way to get home was to orientate yourself to the North Star, because there are no other landmarks at all. And this is what we did night after night. We set out for 12, and then we'd go so far, and we'd go to ground, and then we'd go another odd number of paces to go to ground until we got to where we were lying. And then you'd lie for hours. You'd do some hours just lying there, listening for 12, and it got bitterly, bitterly cold, of course. And you just hope that you surprise the Germans, and they didn't surprise you.
Well, before the Germans came,
Now, we didn't
what
do
was the place like?
Oh, well, it was just, we did a lot of cleaning up, all these as much as we could, these underground fortifications, and make them habitable. But it was just desert with not much else, you know. There's nothing really of interest that you could say about it, really. Because we weren't in near the town. We were out on a perimeter in the desert. And we were actually around on the Derna Road when the Germans arrived. My company was right on the Derna Road. And the Germans came to... We could see them come down in front of us, and then we opened up. And I must now mention the Royal Horse Artillery, because we had an immense admiration for the Royal Horse Artillery. They were both wonderful outfits. They did an absolutely fantastic job. Their officers were fantastic fellows, and they used to go forward on these old pit posts, and they'd sit up on this way out on one of these, just a post, and they'd have a seat up top to direct the artillery fire, which was a fairly vulnerable sort of a position. But they were really great blokes. And they and our, what we used to call a bush artillery, were what we had to defend the brook, because we didn't at that stage have any proper...
Well, you were mentioning earlier that you didn't have much.
No, we didn't, no.
Did you, before the Germans came, did you get an opportunity to see the town at all?
No, not at all, no. No, we just landed and went. Well, we didn't land, actually. We didn't land, no. We came up from Egypt by truck through the desert. And so we didn't really ever go into... It was only in later stages that when we went to unload ships and things like that, we ever went to Tobruk.
Could you tell us a little bit about the layout of Tobruk in regard to the perimeters? I understand that there were several perimeters.
Yes, they did have several perimeters. They had a fallback perimeter. And the idea really was that in some case, she let the Germans came to come into that later times, that came into that, and then the tanks would attack them. But that was later, when the place got more established later months than the early time. But it had several perimeters. In fact, it probably had three perimeters.
Whereabouts?
Three lines behind.
Whereabouts were you in relation to the three?
Oh, we were in the front. We were in the front. In the beginning of the Tulip siege, we were in the front line. Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned that you were on the Derna Road.
Yes.
When the Germans came.
We were. Yeah.
Was that a surprise to see them?
It was a surprise. Yeah. Yeah. I can remember that very vividly.
Well, tell us what went through your mind when you saw the Germans. What was the first?
Well, they came in trucks, and they came in, and they came to the perimeter. And I can still see them getting off those trucks. And I don't know what they expected to find, and then, of course, we opened up on them with small arms fire, and the artillery opened up. But the blokes that were using the bush artillery were quite incredible, because they had no sights. And they used to get some very accurate firing. They didn't, because the Italians, had stripped the guns of the sights. And it's amazing what they did in support. But without the Royal Horse Artillery, I don't know quite how we would have got on.
Up until that time, had there been any thought of the Africa Corps at all?
No. I don't think really we would have even thought of them as the Africa Corps, of course, in those days. They'd just be Germans. It was only later that we started to get... but it was a fascinating place, Tobruk. It's only those... And, of course, another thing in Tobruk which we suffered was an enormous shortage of water. We only had... During the siege, we used to... And we went... I think we went about 3 months without any sort of a bath, and we got a ration of a water bottle a day. Now we had to do everything with that: clean your teeth, submit some to the cookhouse, and drink. And because they wouldn't bring the water carriers, so they had a limited number, they couldn't get any more in. They wouldn't bring the water carriers. Everything had to be carried in cans to the front, all the water. And we used to get desperately thirsty, terribly thirsty. And I can still remember once when a water carrier did come further forward, and we all raced along behind it to try and get some water. And it was there were Tommies driving it. And after that, I think they must have gone back and said how thirsty everybody was, because the water supply improved after that. But we used to get desperately short, particularly if you had to do anything in the heat. You got very, very short, very thirsty. I think I can always remember flies, dust, and thirst in Tobruk. The things that stick in my mind more than anything else. And boredom. Because we had nothing to read. I think I read my New Testament 100 times. Or more, 200 times, with only reading matter. And we had no books or anything like that. And you read letters about 20 times when you did get them, which wasn't terribly often.
What were the feelings that you experienced when you received a letter from home?
Oh, it was wonderful.
When you're in the desert.
Oh, it was wonderful. You know, it's what kept you going, I think, was getting those letters. They were very, very important mail. Sometimes it brought bad news, and that wasn't good, because the person who received it could do nothing about it. But it was a lifeline. Mm. And then in later stages, of course, we went into, take platoons into the town to unload the ships which came in at night. And they used to have to get everything off very quickly so they get out again. Because the Germans used to come in all the time bombing. And because we had no air cover at all. I never saw an Allied plane at any time while we were in Tobruk. Later at Alamein we did, but not in Tobruk. So the Germans had complete control of the air, and they used it pretty. The Royal Navy and those of their own naval craft that were there, they were just wonderful. Marvellous what they did.
Tell us about the Germans. You mentioned, you know, that you saw them coming in. Mm. What were the feelings then of having to suddenly fire upon an enemy?
Well, I think we just suddenly realised it was all dinkum, I think. it was on. I think that was what it was. Yeah. And from then on, of course, things got pretty, you know, pretty concentrated. It was a race against time, really, to get enough defence set up to hold the place. But
you mentioned that the Germans were coming in trucks.
Mm.
Was this a sort of reconnaissance mission, or
I think the first I think the first ones that came there were probably the vanguard of the whole thing, and they struck the perimeter of Tobruk, and then of course they withdrew, and of course they circled around, and then I can't remember just exactly when the first probes came, but then they started probing the perimeter, of course,
which
to find weak
spots.
Oh, they sent in infantry and in some cases tanks, try and find the weak spots.
Did you ever experience tanks coming to your position? Mm. What did it feel like to see, you know, over the horizon the rising dust of a tank patrol?
Not good. No. Very unpleasant. I mean, you haven't got much in the way of weaponry against you. We didn't have really... Our anti-tank guns were very primitive. We didn't have, at that stage, have anything that was really capable of... Not, the only people who really had that were the Royal Horse Artillery. Our guns, I suppose, you could have used them, but you wouldn't have been able to accurately hit tanks. Only the Royal Horse Artillery had the equipment, really, at that stage to do that.
So what would happen then, seeing a tank patrol coming forward? What would go through the front line?
Oh, well, it was just, you were just waiting for them to, and it was a matter of whether they got beaten off or not before they got to you. But fortunately, they never ever got to us. We never actually had them overrun us or anything like that. But, no.
You'd gotten to Tobruk in early April.
Mm.
And it was from that time pretty well that the place was under siege.
Oh, yes.
What did it feel like to be in a situation of being under siege?
Well, I don't know, really. I think we're always very confident. I don't think any of us were worried that we were ever going to get beaten. I don't think that entered anybody's mind that we'd get beaten. And I think that was part of the secret of it, was that everybody was confident. There was no thought that they were going to take Tobruk. And I think our leaders instilled that into us. You know, we had very good leadership in Tobruk.
Tell us about that.
Mm, well, we had our own commander, Brigadier Lloyd, was a very fine soldier, and he organised things very well in our area. And of course, the overall commander of Tobruk was extremely good.
This would have been Morshead, am I right?
Yeah, Morshead. And I think it was a matter of confidence, I think. I think if we hadn't been so very confident, they probably would have taken Tobruk, you know. But everybody was determined they weren't going to, and everybody did their job. But of course, we weren't Australians, weren't the only ones. There were British troops, and there were Indians, and there were, one stage there were Poles. So there were others. We weren't the only ones, but we were the majority.
How did you get on with the other?
Oh, very well. Mm, very well. Yes, we did. We got on very well with all the other troops that were there. There was never any animosity, or it was just, we're all comrades in it together, I think. Not that we saw a lot of them, of course, but they were there supporting us. But the Australians did most of the actual front line infantry work. The Australian Brigade was the main infantry in those days before we were taken out and the South Africans took over.
How long were you in Tobruk for?
It was about nearly 5 months, I suppose.
No.
We left
about August, sometime in August.
Yes.
Tell us generally what the situation regarding things like food in Tobruk. What was that like? You mentioned the water was extremely short. What would the average soldier be eating in Tobruk?
Bully beef, biscuits, and for main meal normally it would be some sort of a stew that would come up, made up of. But we didn't have any fresh vegetables or anything like that. And I can always remember when we got our first tins of M&B, it was just like getting a chocolate cake. Because all we had really was bully beef and biscuits.
Tins of?
Bully beef, which was beef tins.
But you were given M&B.
M&B was a mixture of sort of vegetables and stuff, all mixed up together. It was a change, you see. It was just like getting a wonderful change because we'd had this monotonous food. Because most of the stews were just bully beef. We got things like onions, and they got potatoes, but you didn't get anything else much. So it was pretty monotonous food.
How was it that you were able to keep up, your health?
Well, one stage I got terrible desert sores, and I was literally covered in them all over, and bloody back up in desert sore, which was a result of course of the food and other things. But I didn't think I'd ever get rid of them. And then I remember our chap and our RAP sent me over to the British RAP, and they had sulfanilamide. He wasn't supposed to do this, but they gave me sulfanilamide, and I put it on, and that eventually cleaned them up. But before that, we just couldn't get rid of them. And I think it took quite a lot out of everybody's health.
With the Germans making attacks and probes and things like that, what were you being told by your officers that you had to do? I mean, hold Tobruk is...
Oh, yes, that was basically the whole thing. Everything was designed to hold Tobruk, yeah. And the idea was to... of course, it was hoped, of course, that we'd have been able to break out of Tobruk and join the army coming up from Egypt. But it took a long time, and it really didn't ever happen while we were there.
Well, I was going to discuss that with you. There was an operation called Battle Axe, I think, which involved in June of 1941. The idea was to attack Germans and Italians in Hellfire. Solon and Capuzza, and then meet up with troops breaking out of Tobruk towards Tripoli.
Yeah, but it didn't happen.
So that was one of the ideas to clear the Germans out of the area, but that wasn't a success. As I understand, the command changed after that.
And I think they built Tobruk up as much as they possibly could to be a thorn in Rommel's side, so they had to commit a lot of troops to stop us breaking out of Tobruk and decimating the supply line, because we could hear, at night time, you could hear masses of trucks. You could hear the roar of the trucks going down the roads to Egypt and from Tobruk. You could hear it at night all the time, carrying the supplies down to... And if we'd been able to break out there and get into the road... And cut his supply, And, you know, there's amazing stories that, oh, this, of course, is giving more out of Tobruk, you know, there's some that part of it, but there's some amazing stories of El Alamein and what was done.
Tell us about some of those.
Well, there was one instance where some, I'm not sure if it was a British officer, I think he must have been, but he somehow blotted his copybook, and they drew up some maps, which were completely false. They had the soft sand, which was supposed to be hard, and this chap went out, and I believe was purposely blown up on a mine, and the Germans got this map, and in the battles that followed, Rommel diverted his tanks and sent them into the wrong place, sent them into the hard, the soft stuff instead of the hard, and they all got bogged down. But it was just part of the espionage that was going on.
Mm. Okay, we'll talk about El Alamein a bit later on. What were you hearing about Churchill and what he wanted for Tobruk?
Not a lot, no. We had a Tobruk Times that used to come out. We used to get a news sheet that came out and gave some information. But we didn't hear. Churchill came, of course, in the Alamein days, but not, of course, to Tobruk. We were very much a very isolated spot, dependent completely on the Navy. There was no other way of getting us anything. And the Navy, we lost ships there, and the Royal Navy lost ships. Going, and of course they took the wounded out too. Marvellous job. The British Navy, the Royal Navy, were just wonderful with our wounded taking them out. They did a great job.
Was there any talk at this stage of you being the rats of Tobruk?
Well, the propaganda used to come over, of course. They used to play, you could hear that, they used to play Lily Maline and all those things you could hear coming over the radio to the Germans. And they used to broadcast propaganda.
What was some of the propaganda that you'd hear?
Oh, well, they used to, in later times, of course, they broadcast that Australia was going to be overrun by the Japs and all this sort of thing. The Japs had invaded Australia, and lots of false information was put out. They used to drop the leaflets. But nobody really believed them. I suppose people did worry that there might be some truth in it, but nobody really believed it. And Lord Haw-Haw was broadcasting, of course. He used to broadcast a lot of propaganda. And we did get some of that sort of news on the radio, but not a lot. It was very isolated. We were very isolated from everything.
Mm. You mentioned that there was this boredom.
Oh, yes, terrible boredom. Mm.
How much of, what was the percentage of boredom to
action? Oh, well, all day, you see, virtually all day, you just lay in, you've got what sleep you could, and go as much as you could with the heat. You know, if you were in the cement, down the cement dugouts, it was great, but I can remember being in dugouts, just a dugout, and having just to pull a ground sheet over, keep the flies out, and trying to sleep in the day in the heat was just unbelievably bad. But fortunately, most of the book we were stationed in cement forts, because they were all stationed to be, you know, close enough for mutual defence.
How often during the time that you were there were you attacked by the Germans, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. You mean a major attack? Oh, well, a major attack, I suppose, it would have been the whole battalion. Mm. 12 or 14 major attacks, I suppose. Different parts of the unit during the whole siege. But mainly it was, encountering in patrols and things like that, which didn't involve, you know, a major operation. They were just probing the German lines. And we did much more of that than they did about us. We patrolled out.
What was your idea behind that?
I think there was Morsehead, which was a great thing. He kept the Germans back, you see. He stopped the boats, sending his patrols out. They kept them encroaching and getting closer into our lines. And I think that was his idea, was to keep these patrols continuously going. And every night they were sent out. And there were always patrols and listening posts and all out in the perimeter. But major, I wouldn't like to be accurate on the number of major attacks we had, but there would have been a fairly good number out of the whole unit.
In your experience, how many were you involved with defending?
Oh, the major went about three.
Mm. And what was involved in a major? What was involved in a major attack on
Tobruk? Well, in my part of it, we never got to anything like hand to hand fighting. Although some of the battalion did, of course. But we never got to that stage. It was mainly just to fight, to beat them off type of fighting. They never actually got close enough that we were actually hand-to-hand fighting, anything like that. And in all cases, they were beaten back. Our company was never overrun.
How long did they go on for, those attacks, generally?
Oh, some hours, I suppose. Yeah. Yes, some hours.
Was there a time in the day when they were more likely to take place?
Oh yes, it was normally early in the morning, and there were some sort of dusk attacks, but often early morning. A lot of the fighting was done at night there because it was a more skirmish. It was, you know, what you call it? Well, it was a skirmish war, really, Tobruk, rather than a great big whole front flaring up all at once. And the Germans used to probe different areas, and they'd send an attack to try and get through the perimeter. But and they did sometimes. They did break through, but they were always driven back then. By the second line of defence.
I understand that in some cases the first line of defence would bob down and
let them through. Exactly, yeah. And the Germans used to sometimes carry troops on the back of the tanks, you know, and they'd jump off the tanks. So you sort of, one of the ideas was to lie low, and then when they did that, you open fire on them as they jumped off the tanks. But we did a bit of that ourselves too in later times, set them in on tanks. But now Tobruk was very much a skirmish sort of a war, with probing attacks on both sides, and it was just to hold that fortress so that it was always there as a threat. And that was what the high command's main object was, I'm sure, was just to keep a continual thorn in Rommel's side. And he was hoodwinked a bit. He thought we were much stronger than we were, of course. And in the later memoirs, he's acknowledged that. He thought we were stronger. But we were very lucky in fighting the Afrika Korps, because Rommel, although he was a Nazi, his troops were very good. They treated the prisoners well. And we never had any cases, really, that I know of the Germans mistreating the prisoners in any way. But I think they had a fair, we both had a fair bit of respect for each other. They were a good corps, that Afrika Corps.